Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the September 28th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. There were a number of speeches made by an assortment of world leaders at last week's gathering at the UN General Assembly, but there are two that were of special significance and will not soon be forgotten. That they both concerned the Israel-Palestine conflict was not surprising, nor the fact that they were the most eagerly anticipated. The first was by Mahmoud Abbas, still considered the president of the Palestinian Authority, although his term expired in 2009, and the second was by President Obama. Both men, despite their vastly different positions, brought with them to the UN a well-deserved reputation for cowardice under fire, that is, fire of the political variety. But Abbas, who has spent the better part of the last two decades collaborating with the Israeli government and its occupation policies, but under pressure from the West Bank Palestinians that he still de facto represents, presented a different image to the world body, one that demanded that Palestine be recognized as a UN member state. Barack Obama, however, ran true to form and gave what may have been the most craven speech ever delivered to a major audience by a sitting U.S. president, in which he made it plain to the world that U.S. policy in the Middle East and toward the people of Palestine is determined not by what is in the best interest of the United States, but by the Prime Minister of Israel. There would be no state for Palestine, not as long as he could help it, unless it was first approved by Israel, and that's not in the cards. On the day before Obama's speech, journalist Robert Fisk asked rhetorically in the Independent of London, "Should we say poor old Obama, as I have done in the past? I don't think so. Big on rhetoric, vain, handing out false love in Istanbul and Cairo within months of his election. He will this week prove that his re-election is more important than the future of the Middle East, that his personal ambition to stay in power must take first place over the sufferings of an occupied people. In this context alone," wrote Fisk, "it is bizarre that a man of such opposed high principle should show himself so cowardly. In the new Middle East, in which Arabs are claiming the very same rights and freedoms that Israel and America say they champion, this is a profound tragedy." End quote, Robert Fisk. And as expected, Obama proved Fisk knew his man. Here at home, Robert Dreyfus, writing in The Nation, a magazine that strongly supported Obama in 2008, put it this way, quote, "Barack Obama's appearance at the United Nations was an unmitigated disaster. Like a slow-motion train wreck, one that everyone knew was coming months ago, the president succumbed shamelessly to the domestic political pressure from the Israel lobby, its Republican Party allies, and the menacing Benjamin Netanyahu, the thuggish prime minister of Israel. In one speech," wrote Dreyfus, "Obama smashed to pieces every hopeful speech, false start peace initiative, and half-hearted initiative he's tried since taking office. The appointment of George Mitchell as Middle East peace envoy? Dead. The June 2009 speech in Cairo aimed at rebuilding ties to the Arab and Muslim world? Dead. His feckless call for Israel to stop building illegal settlements on Palestinian land under occupation by Israel's brutish army and a vast militia of armed fanatical settlers? Dead. His weak-kneed call for a deal between Israel and Palestine based on the 1967 borders? Dead as a doornail," end quote. That's Robert Dreyfus in The Nation. In Israel, Jerusalem Post editor Herb Kanan was in a celebratory mood. "It took some 34 months," wrote Kanan, "but on Wednesday at the UN, Israel finally heard the speech it wanted to hear from U.S. President Barack Obama. Gone were so many elements of previous Obama speeches on the Middle East that rankled so many Israelis and left a taste in many people's mouths that here was a president who simply did not get us, who did not understand our history, our daily reality, or our fears," end quote. Herb Kanan, Jerusalem Post. Pleased. True, there was not a word about settlements, not a word about Jerusalem, not a word about the 67 borders from the president, just that the Palestinians needed to get back to the negotiating table, leaving unsaid but implied the need for Abbas to get back to licking Benjamin Netanyahu's boots, just as Obama himself has learned to do. In fact, listening to Obama's speech, if one doesn't know better, you would come away thinking it was Israel that was under occupation, that it was Israel that was under siege. Obama had been very public in his efforts to convince Abbas and the Palestinian Authority not to bring the issue of Palestinian statehood before the UN, but as Robert Fisk had written a year before, nobody listens to Obama anymore. That Obama was willing to sacrifice what are clearly other pressing U.S. interests in the turbulent Middle East, to unabashedly take Israel's side and pressure other countries to do the same, should raise a number of serious questions about who is behind his candidacy. This is particularly relevant when learning, according to Newsweek, that right after he came into office, the Ig Nobel Nobel Prize winner approved the shipping of 55 U.S. GBU-28 bunker-busting bombs to Israel that it might use to bomb either Iran or Lebanon, something that George W. Bush had refused to do. There have been numerous reports that a large portion of the American Jewish community is dissatisfied with Obama because of his attitude toward Israel. Yet it turns out he has provided more military weaponry and intelligence information to the Jewish state than any of his predecessors. 2 weeks before he was elected, the Chicago Jewish Daily News had a long article about Obama's close ties with that city's Jewish community. And not just with his liberal elements, but also with right-wing Republicans such as Lester Crown and Penny Pritzker, who became the chief financial officer of his presidential campaign. She was also one of the initiators of what came to be called subprime lending, which is why she bowed out of a prospective appointment for Commerce Secretary when Obama came into office. What was interesting is that the same article quoted Avner Mikva, a former Clinton appointee, as predicting that Obama would be, quote, the first Jewish president, unquote. Today, if one looks at the cover of the latest New York Magazine, one will see a photograph of the back of Obama's head, capped by a yarmulke, and the headline, the first Jewish president, unquote. How the U.S. media has dealt with this issue is going to be the topic of today's interview. When about 20 minutes past the hour, I would be speaking with Allison Weir, a media analyst who is the founder and director of If Americans Knew and the president of the Council for the National Interest, a lobbying organization critical of U.S. policy towards Israel based in Washington. In the meantime, let's get back to some more news on that subject. As if to rub Abbas's and Obama's faces in the ground, the Israeli government announced yesterday that it is set to approve 1,100 new housing units in the Gilo settlement, which Israel claims is part of Jerusalem, despite past U.S. objections concerning any further construction across the Green Line. The plan was submitted by a subsidiary to the Jewish National Fund, an Israeli as well as U.S. tax-exempt organization. Hillary Clinton's comment, this is not constructive. An interesting sidelight to what happened at the UN are the comments of former President Bill Clinton, her hubby, who while in office was considered, quote, the best president Israel ever had, taking over that mantle from Ronald Reagan and later surrendering it to George W. Bush. Just a year ago this month, at a program he hosts annually called the Clinton Global Initiative, the former president was quoted as saying that the problem for Israel is its Russian-speaking Jewish immigrant, its Russian-speaking immigrant population. Said Clinton, an increasing number of the young people in the Israeli Defense Forces are the children of Russians and settlers, the hardest core people against the division of the land. This presents a staggering problem, Clinton said. It's a different Israel. 16% of Israelis speak Russian, end quote. According to Clinton, the Russian immigrant population in Israel is the group least interested in striking a peace deal with the Palestinians because, he says, they've just got there. It's their country. They made a commitment to the future there. They can't imagine any historical or other claims that would justify dividing it, end quote. Now, at this year's get-together, just last week on the sidelines of the UN meeting, Clinton shifted the blame to Netanyahu, whose government moved the goalposts, he said, upon taking power, and his rise represents a key reason there's been no Israeli-Palestinian peace deal, according to Clinton. The Netanyahu government has received all the assurances previous Israeli governments said they wanted, but now won't accept those terms to make peace, said Clinton. Now if they have all these things, They don't seem so important to this current government, partly because it's a different country, he added. In the interim, you've had all these immigrants coming in from the former Soviet Union, and they have no history in Israel proper, so the traditional claims of the Palestinians have less weight with them, end quote. Clinton, it should be remembered, had his own problems with Netanyahu while in office, and when he made a move to pressure the Israeli prime minister, then in his first term, to give up more land to the Palestinians, he found himself blindsided by members of his own Democratic Party who sided with Netanyahu, which was also the experience of Obama. I should also add that the Russian immigrants had no experience with democracy and do not have much use for it, according to polls. On a local note, there was some good news. I received an email yesterday from the Obama campaign informing me that I have yet to make a donation, quote, something you don't have in common with 73 other supporters of this movement who tell us they live in Ukiah, California. It went on that many of your neighbors have decided to own a piece of this campaign by making a donation of whatever they could afford. For some, that meant just $5. For others, it meant $100 or more. But each had their own personal reason for giving. Our records show, the message went on, that you aren't one of the 73 people where you're from who has stepped up for 2012. Now is your chance to change that, end quote. The good news? That only 73 residents of Ukiah have donated to Obama's campaign. I'm sure the number was far larger in 2008. Then yesterday came a message, purportedly from Obama, asking me for just $3, that's right, $3, and a chance to have dinner with him. It came on the heels, ironically, of a $38,500, a plate dinner, fundraising dinner, which he held in San Francisco, in which no local media were invited or allowed to attend, which drew a strong editorial rebuke from the San Francisco Chronicle. In fact, local reporters were barred from all of his Bay Area appearances. Obama also drew a rebuke from Los Angeles congressional veteran Maxine Waters for the manner in which he addressed the Congressional Black Caucus in one of his rare meetings with the group last week. Waters is angry about Obama's admonition to black Americans to, quote, stop complaining, end quote. She insisted during an interview on the early show on CBS that he wouldn't speak to any other group in such a disparaging way. Obama, speaking Saturday at an awards dinner for the Congressional Black Caucus, said those present should, quote, take off your bedroom slippers, put on your marching shoes, shake it off, stop complaining, stop grumbling, stop crying. We are going to press on. We've got work to do, CBC, end quote. Speaking on CBS's The Early Show, Waters said, I don't know who he was talking to because we're certainly not complaining. We are working. We support him. We are protecting that base because we want people to be enthusiastic about him when that election rolls around, end quote. Maxine Waters. She said, I found his language a bit curious because the president spoke to the Hispanic caucus, and certainly they are pushing him on immigration. He's appointed Sotomayor to the Supreme Court, and he has an office for excellence in Hispanic education right in the White House. They are still pushing him, and he certainly didn't tell them to stop complaining, end quote. Waters didn't mention it, but Obama and his top staff members have met numerous times, either directly or through conference calls, with Jewish community leaders, and we can be assured that he did not tell any one of them to stop complaining. The pro-Israel lobby is not without its influence across the water. 2 weeks ago, British Ambassador to Israel Matthew Gold announced that Thursday, that the Queen of England had signed an amendment to a bill that will prevent the issuing of arrest warrants against Israeli officials. According to Gold, quote, the Police Reform and Social Responsibility Act, which has now received royal assent, that's the Queen, includes an important amendment to ensure that the UK's justice system can no longer be abused for political reasons. He added that, quote, the change will ensure that people cannot be detained when there is no realistic chance of prosecution, while ensuring that we continue to honor our international obligations, end quote. In the past, a number of Israeli officials have hesitated to visit Britain because of the threat of being arrested for war crimes. Now the criminals will be apparently able to visit Britain whenever they wish without fear. It's now 18 minutes after the hour, and time to get my guest, Allison Weir, on the phone.